From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Racial inequality and segregation is thriving in America's cities. A new set of rules from the Obama administration aims to change that by forcing cities to face the reality of their own inequalities. Some call it social engineering. Others applaud the effort. This hour on Point, new regulations to unwind the forces that led to today's racial segregation. You can join us on air or online. Do you see the disparity in your city? Struggling neighborhoods that are often hard to escape. Should the government step in or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Washington this hour is Emily Badger. She covers urban policy for The Washington Post. Welcome to On Point, Emily.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let's play President Obama here first in his weekly radio address on Friday, touting his administration's new rules aimed at improving housing policies.
In this country, of all countries, a person's zip code shouldn't decide their destiny. We don't guarantee equal outcomes, but we do strive to guarantee an equal shot at opportunity in every neighborhood for every American.
Emily Badger, you broke the news of the Obama administration's efforts on this. There he is saying a person's zip code should not decide their destiny. Explain these new housing rules.
Sure. So the Fair Housing Act, going all the way back to 1968, had these two pieces to it. The first piece is the part that we're all very familiar with. This is the piece that says that you cannot discriminate based on race in the housing market. You know, this is the part that bans real estate agents from steering black families away from white neighborhoods. This is the part that bans landlords from refusing to rent to black families. You know, this is the part that's been enforced for the last 47 years that most of us are quite familiar with. But then there was this second piece of the law that has been in there all of this time. And this is the piece that said that the federal government has a responsibility not just to ban discrimination, but to actively try to promote integration in its place and to try to dismantle segregation. This is the part of the law that sort of refers to affirmatively furthering fair housing that says that, you know, it's not enough to stop doing the bad thing. You also have to start doing the good thing. And what the Obama administration said last week effectively was, you know, the federal government and communities all over the country have basically been ignoring this part of the law for a very long time. And now we're going to force you to start taking it seriously.
So the Fair Housing Act of 68 said that towns and cities were supposed to actually go out to ensure fair housing, make sure there was not discrimination, just not write it in the law. And apparently it's just never been enforced.
That's exactly right. And what they're asking communities to do at this point is every 3 to 5 years on a recurring basis to conduct these very intricate analyses of what do your housing patterns look like? Where does segregation exist? How have your segregation patterns changed over the years? You know, are your areas of concentrated poverty the same places that are racially segregated? Do low-income families live far from good schools? Do they live far from public transit? You know, these are all questions that they are now going to tell communities you need to start assessing. And, you know, once communities go through this exercise, then they're going to be required to come up with proposals for how they plan to affirmatively attack these problems in the future. And then HUD is saying that it's going to follow up and track whether or not you actually follow through on what you said you were going to do.
Here's Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro announcing the new rule to help communities meet fair housing obligations. WBEZ reporter Natalie Moore asked him how this can help the area around Chicago.
We very much encourage communities to work regionally. The impact of policies that too often have kept families that are of modest means hemmed in to certain places. It ought to be a regional approach. Regionalism is often easier said than done. There's nothing in here that is dictating to communities how they're going to achieve these goals. But we encourage communities to work in a regional way.
And here's an interview with WBEZ in Chicago, again, reporter Natalie Moore, asking Marissa Novara of the Metropolitan Planning Council there what this new rule could mean for Chicago.
There would be tremendous benefit to the Chicago region to think more in those terms. And I think it would, if they did that, if the region acted in that manner, it would have an impact on this kind of ruling in the sense that people are thinking across the board about where do we house people? How do we provide a base quality of life for people across our region? And not just, oh, it's all in that one part of the region. That's not my problem.
So, Emily Badger, there's the question. How do we do this? Julian Castro is saying, practically speaking, we're not going to dictate to communities how they're going to achieve these goals. So what are they going to do?
HUD has been incredibly sensitive in how they've rolled this out, in part because they're aware of the fact that this is a hot-button topic. This rule has the potential to be very controversial. And so, you know, they have said again and again, we want to work with communities. We don't want to dictate to them. You know, this is all about us providing communities data, helping them comply with the law, helping them comply with a requirement that they have technically been supposed to be dealing with for quite a long time now. So, you know, they're really trying to de-emphasize what the punitive element of this could be, but there is, in fact, one in there. And that is that HUD every year doles out billions of dollars in local housing and development grants to local communities. And, you know, they have suggested that for the communities, and they think that this will be a very small number of them, that really don't want to go along with this exercise, that, you know, really are going to stand in the way of desegregation, the threat that they're holding out is that potentially maybe you won't get that money from HUD in the future if you're not going to do this.
Hmm. Well, some local governments have already done that, right? I mean, places in New York have chosen to forego federal HUD funding so they don't have to comply with fair housing requirements. Are we going to see more of that?
You know, there part of what you're suggesting is that HUD has been in this legal dispute with Westchester County, New York, for several years. And Westchester has effectively said, you know, we're not going to apply for community development block grant money anymore because there are just too many strings attached to it. You know, you get involved with the federal government and then the federal government comes in and starts telling you, you know, how where you should put your affordable housing. And I would suspect that there are going to be some other communities who are going to say the same thing. But one of the products of the fact that we have really not had this conversation in this country for a very long time is that we don't know exactly how many communities are going to say that. We don't know what share of them are really going to embrace this exercise and what share are going to be really disturbed by it.
Well, then where will these housing requirements pose the greatest challenge, I guess, is the question. What cities have the highest levels of segregation and residential discrimination?
Well, big cities like Chicago, like Boston, like Washington, Philadelphia, these are places where the housing patterns that exist today are the product of decades of institutional discrimination, public policy, decisions that go all the way back to the 1930s and 40s. And so in these communities where these patterns are so entrenched, we're talking about starting to try to undo something now that has been built up over decades. And it's going to be an incredibly difficult process in those places.
Emily Badger covers urban policy for The Washington Post. Emily, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Joining me now from Dallas, Texas, is Marianne Russ. She's president of the Dallas Housing Authority, which has been participating in an experiment that offers low-income residents vouchers to live in more expensive neighborhoods. Marianne, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Well, you hear Emily Badger saying we're trying to do it, undo something here that's been going for a very long time. Explain the zip code voucher policy that you've worked on in Dallas.
Okay. Well, as you know, the Section 8, it's called the Section 8 or Housing Choice Voucher Program, has been around since 1974. But in 2010, HUD, in response to a lawsuit, started an experiment here in Dallas that is now being expanded across the country, in which for the metro area, which is a seven-county area, the county of Dallas and then the six counties around it, instead of having one set of rents set by HUD and thus subsidy standards for the families participating, they went with zip code-based subsidy standards, which means that in a better neighborhood, your voucher is worth more money.
Hmm. So families in Dallas who qualify for subsidies are offered more money if they move to a more expensive neighborhood?
Well, they don't get the money. The landlord gets
the
money,
voucher,
but,
right.
But the voucher is worth more money depending on where you lease.
I see.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it was based on zip codes because, of course, every address has a zip code. So and by assigning their subsidies that way, it was easy.
I see. And you cut subsidies for families or the vouchers if they don't go or will not go?
No, that's not exactly how it works.
Okay.
What happened was when we had one subsidy standard for the whole six-county region, out in the rural areas, because some of the surrounding counties are very rural, I mean, there's ranching and farming out there, the rents were dandy. They were great. You could rent something very nice. But in Dallas, where the rents are higher, people tended to cluster in neighborhoods characterized by fewer services, but worse transportation and lower housing quality. And indeed, we had that same clustering effect in Dallas. And people were clustered in the neighborhood where the lowest rents were available, although a lot of the housing we couldn't assist because it didn't pass the standards. And what happened when they went into the small area fair market rents, the zip code-based rents, was the rents went down in those neighborhoods. So if you stayed there, your share of the rent on your second recertification mm-hmm. would go up instead of staying the same.
Ah.
So people had an incentive to move to a better neighborhood.
I see. And so
that's the ability.
And so what's been the impact of this? You have 18,000 families, is that right, that you're serving?
We have just under 18,000 families, and we've had 5,053 families move to different zip codes since this started in March of 2011. And people are moving for all the reasons everybody moves. If you have school-age kids, to get to a better school.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had a terrible commute, to get closer to your job. If you really need to be close to some kind of a health facility, to get closer to that necessary facility. So,
but how do you measure success? How do you measure success, Marianne, in this program?
I think the way, we measure it two different ways. First of all, we look at the overall housing quality, and we say, you know, okay, you're no longer in a high crime neighborhood. You're no longer in a neighborhood where a lot of the properties don't even pass the housing quality standards. That is certainly a physical way to measure it. But more importantly, over time, are your kids staying in school? Are your kids going to college? Do you have a better job? Do you have a job at all? If you are 45% of the family heads are either seniors or people with disabilities, you know, is your life better?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about housing inequality in the United States and new rules from the federal government aimed at desegregating our cities and towns. You can join the conversation. Are you stuck in a bad neighborhood? Why can't you get out? What are the long-term costs to staying for you, for your children? Do you agree with President Obama that the government should step in? With me is Marianne Russ, president of the Dallas Housing Authority. Marianne, here's some Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Julian Castro again speaking with PBS NewsHour on Thursday, saying that these changes could take a while.
We really are in it for the long haul, and these communities will now be required to put together a plan on how they're making efforts to affirmatively further fair housing every 5 years when they submit what's known as their consolidated plan. We're confident that over the long haul, that's going to mean that more families have good housing opportunities.
So the housing plans expected now every 5 years from cities and towns across the country. You've been at this now for what, 4 or 5 years? How long before you saw real change, real outcome?
We saw change for individual families within the first year. But, of course, that's anecdotal evidence. At this point, we've been in it, as I said, since March 1st of 2011, and we're starting to see real program changes because one of the things that's counterintuitive, I mean, we expected this to be more expensive in terms of the amount of subsidy dollars going out, and it hasn't been. And the reason we think is because, first of all, the rents and the subsidies have gone down in the most depressed neighborhoods. So people who chose to stay there are paying more, and we're paying less. And some of the people who move to better neighborhoods have better jobs. And since they have better jobs, they pay a higher share of the rent because in this program, your income rules your rent. Mm-hmm. Your rent is based mm-hmm. on your income. Mm-hmm. So if your income goes up, so does your share of the rent.
Is it an easy transition for low-income families to move to different neighborhoods, often to affluent neighborhoods?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think it's very challenging. Mm. And I think it's demanding for everybody concerned. I mean, if you're asking people to move away from their support systems, and that's not easy at all. But I think families look at what this choice can mean for their immediate family, a family of kids, for them and their children, and they say, you know what? I don't want my children to be in subsidized housing for the rest of their lives.
Hmm.
And education is the answer to that. There's no question.
From our Facebook page, Eduardo says, isn't there a simpler way? Issue school vouchers to decouple zip codes from educational opportunities.
Well, if you did that in Dallas, kids couldn't get to the schools anyway. I mean, that assumes that the schools are easily accessible. They're not.
And what's been the response, Marianne, from people who live in the neighborhoods, in the more affluent neighborhoods? Does it make sense for them that the government is subsidizing higher rents?
It's hard to tell. We don't get a lot of feedback from the neighbors because as individual families move in, you know, they don't come with a tag on their back that says, I'm here with subsidy. There's no way for anyone to know. All they know is, you know, they have new neighbors. The apartment next door turned over and somebody new lives in it. Dallas is, especially the suburbs, are becoming more integrated than they used to be. So just because the person who moves in doesn't look like you doesn't mean that they're there on a subsidy.
What does the research, Marianne, show about where a child grows up and how that shapes their prospects as an adult?
Well, as the president said and Secretary Castro echoed, zip code should not equal destiny. You know, the research shows that if you grow up in an area of high poverty and low opportunity, it takes a remarkable person to lift themselves out of that. And it's not that it never happens. It certainly does. We all have seen examples of it. But it's so much more difficult. If you go to a school where just graduating from that school is going to limit your college choices, you know, that's going to be bad for you.
Let's get Jonathan in here, calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to On Point.
Good to be here, Jane. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out I have a background. I am what's known as a title examiner by trade, which means that I research property records, in particular in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, but I've done it in many places throughout the country. And I've actually seen in the chains of title dating from the 1930s the patterns of legally enforced segregation that was done, you know, by the FHA's policies of not issuing federally insured mortgage insurance.
And briefly, what does it show? What have you seen, Jonathan?
Okay, well, I've seen how these patterns go there. I'm also a graduate of the Community Development Program with Roger Williams. And what you basically see is how these patterns self-reinforce not only racial but economic segregation. This leads to repeated bouts of foreclosure and abandonment. This has terrible consequences for the families. And this leads to worse and worse educational and economic outcomes.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Marianne, I would just throw this. Yeah, okay. But what about the critics who say, you know, the government should stay out of this, stay out of neighborhoods. This is social engineering at its best, government overreach. What do you say to that?
What I say is the Fair Housing Act has been the law since 1968, and the fact that it hasn't been enforced doesn't mean it's not the law. You get to live where you can afford to live, but you don't get to choose your neighbors.
Marianne Ross is president of the Dallas Housing Authority. Marianne, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Let me bring in a couple of other voices now. Joining me from Washington is Cheryl Cashin. She's professor of law at Georgetown University, where she teaches race and American law, among other things. Her most recent book is Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Cheryl, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
Also joining me from Washington, Edward Pinto. He's a resident fellow and co-director of the Center of Housing Risk at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank that supports free market solutions. Welcome to On Point, Edward Pinto.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Cheryl, I'll start with you. To your mind, why are these new rules important?
Well, they're important because you have the federal government acknowledging its sin in creating and perpetuating these patterns of segregation. One thing that's been missing from this conversation is an acknowledgement that the social engineering in housing patterns began long before these rules. The federal government, beginning in the 30s, as the caller Jonathan pointed out, taught the lending and housing insurance industry, the mortgage insurance industry, redlining. Then the federal government created the modern black ghetto. Black people and low-income people used to live in strategic areas among more affluent people. But beginning with urban renewal in 49, they removed black populations from desirable areas to more marginal neighborhoods. With the interstate highway program in the 50s, they decimated mostly black neighborhoods and erected, with new highways, firewalls that established the so-called good and bad sides of town. And then, most tragically, in the 50s and 60s, through the federally sponsored and locally administered public housing programs, they placed black public housing residents in buildings and neighborhoods that were where virtually everyone around them were poor. And white public housing residents weren't likely to find that. So the federal government created the ghettos that caused the kind of upheaval in the 60s, you know, that the Kerner Commission said, we need to respond to this.
Ed Pinto, jump in here. You've been following housing issues since the early 70s. You hear the history there from Cheryl. How do you see this issue? How do you see these new rules?
Thank you, Jane. Yes, I got into affordable housing in 1974, right out of law school with the Michigan State Housing Development Authority. And ironically, that's when the voucher program that was discussed in an earlier segment was started. And I've also looked at the history that Cheryl talks about. Fact is, Chicago was the most segregated city in the United States in 1934, before FHA started, before any of these programs started. There was a history of segregation in the United States that goes back a long time, and Chicago is at the peak. And it still is probably the most segregated large city in the United States. So we haven't made much progress. I agree with a lot of what Cheryl said, which is the whole point about social engineering. The government has been social engineering for decades and decades. When the public housing program was started in 1937, expanded in 1949, its goal was to, quote, demolish slums and provide decent, safe, and sanitary housing. The result was, as Cheryl pointed out, most of these were disasters. Most of them were dynamited. The goal of urban renewal, which Cheryl also talked about, was to bring federal programs to bear on clearing slums and stopping onslaughts of blight. The idea might have made sense, but the execution was a disaster.
And so the government now says it's making good on, you know, prior
history. The government now
says
it's going to undertake another way of dealing with this. Einstein said, if you do the same thing over and over again and expect different results, that's the definition of insanity. I found a report that was made to the predecessor of HUD in 1960 that, quote, the federal aid provided under these programs discourage local initiative and impose a uniform pattern of action bureaucratically dictated from Washington. I don't see how what's being proposed by HUD today is really different in substance or in kind from what they've done all along.
Cheryl Kasson, to
solutions.
Speak to that, talk about the history here. HUD's had a terrible history, Edward's saying, of success in this area. Why should this be different?
Well, the rules are dramatically different from the past. First of all, this is a compromise rule. It's not the federal government dictating where affordable housing should be located. It's a compromise that allows the localities to plan for how they are going to affirmatively further fair housing. You know, and it also represents a dramatically different social vision than the nefarious history I talked about. The point of the Fair Housing Act, when it was passed in 1968, was to create, in the words of Walter Mondale, who was one of the chief sponsors, a truly integrated society with balanced living patterns. Every community in America that receives any federal funds, the point is the federal government will not encourage segregation, it'll encourage integration, and it's giving communities tools to figure out how it can be inclusive. And I want to point out, there's a lot of success on the ground. There are places like Seattle, Salt Lake City, Montgomery County, and you can see the example of Dallas, where people have said, we want to be an inclusive society that allows families of all colors and economics to be able to have social mobility.
Cheryl,
and
let's hear from somebody, Cheryl, who's been through this. Let me get a caller in here. Diva is in New Orleans, Louisiana. Diva, welcome to On Point. Tell us your story.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, my mother is disabled. She has been on Section 8 for quite some time now, and it's been a serious obstacle finding her housing that is not extremely far from the bus line and to get to, like, a community center so she can have more social interaction with other people and to get to the doctor, simple things like that. And what's really been disheartening is that if I'm working, you know, long hours and I'm not able to go back and forth to take care of things for her needs, it's caused her to be somewhat isolated. And if her voucher was able to afford a better location for a home near a senior center or other people that are elderly that she could be more social and more interactive with, it would make her living a lot happier. And it's been an obstacle. This has been going on for years now, and we are constantly trying to find a new home that's in a better location and so on. So I'm not sure, you know, how they can fix that, but it's really disheartening.
Diva, thank you so much for your call. Ed Pinto, without these new HUD rules, how would you help someone like Diva's mother there in New Orleans?
First of all, let me just say that Montgomery County is a perfect example. There's been no job growth in Montgomery County for about 15 years. So while they've been implementing a lot of different programs, they've actually stamped out job growth, which is the exact opposite of what you want to do. And so what I would do is undertake two things. One is in the single-family area, wealth-building home loans, which I proposed with my colleague here at AEI about a year ago, which would bring less leverage to the housing market and build wealth in a sustainable, reliable way and reduce defaults tremendously, which has been the history of FHA for the last 35 years, foreclosures. So there is a path there. We have this program being undertaken by lenders around the country, and we're talking to many others about participating in this market-based approach. It can also accommodate subsidies at a very low level in terms of cost that's actually rampable. The second thing is the multifamily approach that we've had for a long time in terms of site-based multifamily, low income, hasn't been sustainable because it doesn't take into account the life cycle needs of the building. And so those life cycle needs, after 15 years or so, you need repairs and refurbishment. What HUD is famous for is they keep throwing more subsidies in, on top of subsidies to bail out these failed approaches. What is needed is sustainable financing at the get-go. Again, slightly less leverage at the get-go, a slightly larger replacement reserves, and at the end of 15 years, you can pay for the refurbishment and for the repairs and keep that as not blight, but as a solid housing.
Cheryl, what about Ed's ideas, smarter loan practices? Won't that help families in a different kind of way?
HUD and the federal government created the Black Ghetto. And it is immoral what people who live in concentrated poverty have to live with. And HUD and the federal government have a moral obligation to dismantle the concentrated Black poverty they created. These are only there are only 2,800 census tracts in the United States that feature this kind of ghetto poverty. It's home to only about 8 million people, most of whom are Black, but they loom very large in American race relations because they incubate stereotypes about Black people that make it very hard to redress segregation and pursue the common good. And I think we have a moral obligation to affirmatively dismantle that and give people opportunity to move elsewhere.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about new rules that require cities to take steps to combat housing segregation in the United States. And you can join the conversation. Are we doing enough to make sure everyone gets a fair shot at living in a good neighborhood? Do the Obama administration's new rules go too far or not far enough? Here's some sound of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1966, speaking about the fight for open and fair housing. He told a crowd how his black staff members were rebuffed at real estate offices when they wanted to look for housing in white neighborhoods, but white staff members were not.
We send some of our fine white staff members into those same real estate offices, and the minute the white persons got in, they opened the book. Oh, yes, well, we have several things. Now, what exactly do you want?
With me this hour, Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown University, and Edward Pinto, a resident fellow and co-director of the Center of Housing Risk at the American Enterprise Institute. So many listeners want to join us here. Let's go first to Sarah in Austin, Texas. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So I'm a practitioner here in Austin, and what we have done in Texas is define opportunity primarily by income of the census tract, and that has been taken as part of the way there, but I think something that's very important to note as we take this new trend into effect is that opportunity isn't just about income. It's about access to job centers, access to transportation, access to a full-service grocery store, amenities like parks. Mm. There are many fine neighborhoods, there are urban core neighborhoods that have all that access that don't necessarily meet the income test. So there's got to be a balance between income and other types of opportunity.
Mm. Sarah, thank you very much. Cheryl Cashin, speak to that a little bit and explain in your study and research how residential segregation and racial health disparities are linked. In other words, how a neighborhood environment shapes behavior that affects your health, among many other things.
Well, if you live in concentrated poverty, you know, 40% or more of the people around you are poor, you are in a situation where, by definition, there's limited employment opportunity, weak schools with inexperienced teachers, distressed housing that can make children sick, violence, often few or no grocery stores with healthy food, reduced opportunities for recreation and parks, and the kind of predatory, militarized policing that would not be tolerated in affluent neighborhoods. It's very hard to prosper in that kind of situation. But I want to underscore that this is not just a black thing or a Latino thing. Since 1970, economic segregation has spiked tremendously, and only 42% of all Americans today live in a middle-class neighborhood where they have a fighting chance at access to opportunity. So, you know, what these HUD rules do is help communities of all circumstances, affluent or not, think about how they can be part of the solution in creating sustainable, integrated communities that offer access to everyone. And, you know, 5 to 10% of the U.S. metropolitan population today currently lives in a jurisdiction that has inclusionary zoning ordinances that require or encourage mixed-income housing, and those places tend to have more social cohesion and more opportunity for people of all colors.
Ed Pinto, how do you see that? I mean, jump in here. Speak to that point.
Okay. So let's talk about the voucher solution that Marianne talked about earlier. So as she said, and I agree with because I was there when it was released, started in 1974, it didn't work very well for all the reasons she talked about, but it went on for 40 years. And now they're coming up with a new and improved version. The problem is the vouchers are a lottery. Even if the cost is the same, they can't be extended at a reasonable cost to a large portion of the population in need. So it becomes a lottery. That is not a solution to the problem of giving some people a ticket out and other people don't have a ticket out.
So you help a few, you leave a lot out.
You leave a lot behind. And so again, the poverty is the absence of wealth. And so my approach is, how do we build wealth? The federal government has had a failure at this. Low-income wealth, middle-income wealth has gone down in the last 30 years in the United States. It hasn't gone up. It's been stagnant or gone down. And so we need to turn that around. I see very little in what HUD has proposed that's going to turn that around, particularly because of HUD's history over the last 50 or 60 years. And by that, I mean HUD and its predecessors. Mm. So we have to try something different. And that's why the two solutions I propose are the wealth-building home loan and sustainable financing for low-income housing.
Let's get another call in here. Let me get to Aaron in Detroit, Michigan, then we can talk after. Aaron, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
First of all, I want to say, as I'm listening, I'm reminded of something, I think it was Malcolm Muggeridge said in the 70s, that we've educated ourselves into imbecility. No matter how intelligently you talk about some things, you can't make them go away. You can't legislate tolerance. You can't legislate acceptance, but you can legislate the opposite of those things by not putting certain things in the laws and putting certain things in the laws. But the point is that what we need to do as a nation is we need to acknowledge where we're starting from. We keep pretending we're not as bad as we are, and therefore we're leaving from the wrong place. We can't get to where we're going because we won't acknowledge where we're starting from.
Aaron,
it's bad.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Johnny in Dothan, Alabama. Did I get that right, Johnny? Welcome to On Point.
Yes, you did.
Great.
This is a whole host of issues. And you're talking about upward mobility, and upward mobility would help if the policy is done right. We're speaking of banking. A lot of subdivisions are developed with developers who get guaranteed bank loans, and planning and zoning. Your urban planners that also decide on what's going on in certain sectors.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of sectors are suffering due to the fact they don't have economic development, such as a grocery stores or sit-down restaurants, or even when we talk about parking, you know, recreation parks, baseball fields, softball fields, swimming. One person asked me the other day, why blacks are not playing baseball? Well, there's no facilities in their neighborhood, which means it goes back again to affordable housing.
Johnny, thank you very much. Cheryl Cashin, respond.
Thank you, Johnny, from Dothan. I'm from Huntsville, Alabama, originally. So nice to hear your voice. Let me say this, and this is in response particularly to Ed. He keeps suggesting that HUD is trying the same thing. But HUD is not. What HUD is trying to do, what we have never done in this country since the Civil Rights Movement, is make good on the promise of desegregation. We've tried a little bit of school integration, but we never really attacked fundamentally these patterns of segregation. And in many ways, particularly along lines of class, those patterns have deepened. So what HUD is trying to do is new and different. They're saying, we are going to, you know, make you, if you take federal funds, affirmatively further fair housing. Let's try integrating neighbors. And there's 40 years of research that shows that integration works and it is cheaper.
So, Pinto, does your plan chip away at desegregation, the heart of this issue?
Absolutely. So wealth-building home loans is one of the, as I said, the keystones. And what we've done is say, look, you need to build wealth with buying a house in a reliable way, which probably means you need to buy a smaller house when you start, appropriate house to your where you are in your life cycle. You need to save part of that through the wealth-building home loan amortization. You then can be in a position to take advantage of the other big wealth-building opportunity for those with a job and have access to a 401k, which is the other way you can build wealth. And then over time, by the time your children are ready to go to college, you'll have paid off your home loan, freed up the cash flow This is, I mean, I agree with HUD when they say this is going to take decades to get accomplished. How you accomplish it is where we disagree, but it's going to take two generations. But by the time your children are then 18 years old, you're going to have the cash flow to help pay for their college. And then by the time you're ready, to, 5 or 6 years where you're ready to retire, you're going to have the cash flow to add to your retirement. That, in that way, through generational change, you're going to be able to build wealth, which is going to allow people to move to that move-up home, move to the better neighborhood, move to the better school. You put that in place by starting at the beginning. We have never done that in this country, and it needs to start because we can't solve the problems using the ideas and the methods we've had in the past.
But I see a lot of listeners Cheryl, Ed, who are saying, you know, there's so many barriers to even getting started to that, Ed, and that's the issue. There's so many barriers to even getting started here.
Every one of the plans announced by HUD in the last 6 or 8 years always said that they didn't say we're going to have failure. They said we're going to have success. This is a new way. This is a new day. And each time it didn't work.
Let's get James in here from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, James. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, James, for
yes,
taking my call.
You bet.
A lot of your guests, they put out a lot of numbers and ideas and stuff like that, but they really don't talk about what really happens in the process. Here in South Carolina, Columbia area, we had that situation where we had a affluent area, and it was a mix of races. It wasn't just white people. They tried to move low-income people out into the area. The jobs were there. The parks were there. The sports programs were there. What came with that was crime and gangs. So the affluent people, different races, moved away from that area and created another area. So now what happens is that area diminishes and nobody wants to go in there and you're stuck with what you've tried to produce. So why don't we try to solve the problem that happens when you move low-income people into those areas first before you do that? And when I say low-income, I'm talking about different races because we have low-income race varieties here.
All right, James, thank you. Cheryl, what do you make of that, these HUD programs that have gone on, but, you know, crime went up, gangs went up, he's seen a pattern there.
I can also cite success stories, you know, particularly success stories with, you know, the Gautreau program in Chicago, the families that have moved in Baltimore because of the Thompson suit, mobility programs where – and your guests from Dallas can cite examples of people who moved to a higher opportunity place, suddenly stopped having asthma attacks. Children initially challenged and struggling in school, but doing much better on all kinds of indicia of success. Parents being more motivated, getting higher jobs, as your guest from Dallas has said, all right? You know, I can tell you this, though. Doing more of the same, which is encouraging segregation, which is immoral and wrong and against the law, you will continue to incubate a bad situation. Now, I want to again say there's a lot more tolerance in American society for people living among all different types of people than there used to be. And the silver lining I see in the demonstrations and dialogue we've been having, you know, since Ferguson erupted last summer, that people of all colors and elected officials from both political parties are beginning to say that we can and should do better than mass incarceration and militarized policing. And my hope is that we can bring some of that consensus to bear on the fundamental underlying issue of segregation. And if you're listening to me, callers, and you believe and want to be part of the solution, I encourage you to go to a website for an organization called Building One America, which I'm a part of. We're going to be having a national summit in my law school on July 23rd. Come and join us and help try to create a positive, inclusive situation in your community.
We're running out of time here. Let me get Jerry in from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm wondering if it's still the situation that HUD vouchers typically force individuals to live alone. They're not allowed to maybe have two young women with a child each to act as roommates. That has an effect of people learning not to be community, but landlords win by providing single units rather than units where people can be roommates.
Got it. Jerry, thank you. Ed Pinto, do you know the answer to that?
Well, let me just say on this segregation, people of wealth for people of color, the original ideas for the wealth-building home loan approach I talked about at a national conference here a little over a year ago, May of 2014, at the Color of Wealth. And I spoke about how to do this approach with less leverage. I was roundly criticized, including by the founder of NACA, the neighborhood, the National Community Action Program that Bruce Marks founded. And we got into a conversation, Bruce and I, after that. And today, NACA, in its 30-plus program offices around the country, offers the wealth-building home loan. They call it the Freedom Mortgage. And next month, they expect to have about 1 in 5 of their low-income buyers take the wealth-building approach. We think that's creating change on the ground that will pay off. Again, it's not instant, but over a generation is going to have huge change in terms of changing segregation.
I don't see Ed's ideas about wealth building as being mutually exclusive with an effort now to get going on serious desegregation.
What are the next steps then, Cheryl Cashin? Where do we go from here as far as these new rules the Obama administration has put forward?
Well, again, you get more integration when you have civic engagement. Like I said, places like Seattle, Salt Lake City, Montgomery, they have higher social mobility for poor kids, and they tend to be more integrated because they've made policy choices to further integration, but they also tend to have higher degrees of civic engagement. And so, you know, if you care about this issue, be part of the solution and help organize a grassroots constituency for integration in your area.
A hot-button issue, as we have heard this hour. Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown University. Her most recent book is Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Thank you for your time today, Cheryl.
Thank you.
And Ed Pinto is a resident fellow and co-director of the International Center on Housing Risk at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for your time today, too, Ed.
Thank you, Jane. Pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.